Step button there. There we go.
Right.
All right, folks.
It's showtime.
Close the doors.
What do they say in Parliament?
Something the doors. Lock the doors.
They're coming through
the
window.
That's the word they use. Yeah.
Ring the bells.
Yeah, ring and ring the bells.
Yeah.
Division required. Ring the bells. Ladies and gentlemen, it's 2 o'clock. You're in the haunted house, and it's the fan history panel. So. Well, I didn't ever expect that. All right, let me just start by saying that because first of all, what's his name? Mervyn Binns. Mervyn Binns is crook and can't come. He sends his apologies. Therefore, we have only two members of the original science fiction, Melbourne science fiction group here, who are Dick and Lee. So because we have this rare opportunity...
Can I interrupt you here?
No. I'm about to say, Lee, that people can't interrupt.
Oh.
And the reason they can't interrupt is to give us some free time for you two to talk about your experiences and memories and thoughts. So that if you interrupt me, then you can only say less later.
Oh, okay.
Does that make sense?
Oh, yeah.
All right, Lee. Because you're special... Well, special? Not quite sure. Because you're Lee, yes, what were you going to say?
I just want to welcome all my great-great-grandchildren because you wouldn't be here today if science fiction fandom hadn't begun in Melbourne with the Melbourne Science Fiction Club.
Hey, Grandpa, you need to use the microphone.
We need to leave.
You want me to use the microphone?
Yes, please.
Oh, okay. Would you like me to sing for you? You know, in that sexy way they do. Okay, right. I'm using the microphone.
Yes. All right, so the other thing I was going to say, it's a pity that Mervyn isn't here because if it wasn't for Mervyn, none of us would be here.
Yes.
Mervyn Binns is the rock upon which we are all based, on which we're all found. And if you haven't got a copy of the handout, they probably run out by now. Oh, good, glad to hear it. Okay, so let me start by introducing the panel to you. And at the left, we have the Neo fan of the collection. His name is Rob Durand. His name first appears in the historical record in 1967 when he was the assistant editor of the Australian Science Fiction Review. I see Tony Thomas here. It was also listed at some stage as being an assistant editor of the Australian Science Fiction Review. Well, I see you in the last issue. I wonder if the two are related to each other in some way. Let us move along to... Next we have Dick Jensen, who is also a founder member of the Melbourne Science Fiction Club. And for those of you with a handout, if you look on the front page, on the top right-hand corner, is a picture of the founders of the Melbourne Science Fiction Club, including Lee Harding and Dick Jensen.
Behind the camera.
Lee's not there because he took the picture. Dick Jensen, founding member of the club, also a well-known fan artist who won the Rotzler Award last year for a lifetime achievement in science fiction. Am I correct in assuming, Dick, that you're also the first person to model weather in the Southern Hemisphere?
I believe so.
We'll leave that aside. and I was reading a correspondence I had with John Bankston the other day where he was talking... We must have had committee meetings at Dick's place. And he said he'd enjoyed them so much because of Dick and his seemingly inexhaustible fond of intellectual games, his thought stories and his impish good humour. Let us move along to Lee Harding, who...
Sorry, interrupt.
You missed something.
Interrupt the...
Yes,
my fondness for games also meant that I spent most of my time on Australia's own computer siren, inventing games to play.
And he's the inventor of the Dittmar, and the first sponsor. This is Dittmar. Yes, come on. Some of you have won them. You might continue.
Already this panel is out of my control. And the reason for this is Lee Harding, of course, a well-known writer, photographer, bon vivant, raconteur, it says here, good friend, it says here. He's published some of Australia's best science fiction and some of Australia's best science fiction fanzines. He's also been involved, Mervyn. Like Mervyn in particular, with just about most of the important things that happened in Australian fandom, and probably most importantly from our point of view, being involved with the 1956 convention and with the Australian Science Fiction Review thereafter. I was reading a letter the other day where Lee wrote to John and said, John Bankston, who produced ASFR, and said, why aren't there any more ASFRs? And John wrote back and said, because you've stopped writing for me. Okay. Mervyn Binns isn't here. As I said, he's the rock upon which we were all sort of sailing. Rock upon which we are sailing. All right. My name's Lee Edmonds. I'm a past ACTI fan. I must have produced 600, 700 fanzines, been involved in running conventions, and then one day I discovered history. I went off and did a PhD and I sort of gaffiated. And now I'm back to write a history of Australian science fiction fandom. This will be book 14 or 15, depending on what happens with other things. I've lost track. But the thing about this is that I'm enjoying this process. Impish humour.
Dick thinks that you should explain what gaffiate means.
Oh, gaffiate.
I should add that Dick is a noted historian now and has published several local histories, and this is a huge undertaking he's on now.
Yeah. Gaffiate means getting away from it all. In the terms in which it used, it means getting away from science fiction fandom. And actually, I was not so much gaffiated as faffiated, because any of you who've done PhDs, and there are several in the room, will know that the PhD expands to fit your brain and squeezes out other things. Well, at least it happened to me, and I just sort of got about stuff. So I'm writing this history. Now, as part of this history, I'm producing a little electronic fanzine called IOTA. The I is there because everything's got an I in front of it these days. And the OT means Olympicon to Aussiecon. So I'm focusing this history on the period between 1956 and 1975, between the first national convention in Melbourne in 1956 and the first Australian convention in Melbourne in 1975. There's a lot more that happens before and after, and they will get chapters. But I'm unpacking this particular period, partly because it's interesting in terms of the history of science fiction fandom, but also because it's a period of great cultural change in Australia. If you remember censorship, 6 o'clock closing, a whole stack of things that Australia was like in 1956. And these two will remember what Melbourne was like in 1956. Oh. We'll ask them questions later. So the point of this history is to explain fandom in terms of the society in which it grew up. Okay, what I want to talk about, so I'm producing this fanzine, it has a fanzine review. The next issue will have Shane McCormick's Terran Tans 5 published in 1970 reviewed. There will be a write-up of the Third National Convention written by Ian Crozier. There will be a letter column in which several of the people in this room have contributed. Whatever else takes my fancy, and there will be a lesson in history, because people think that you can just write history because you remember the past. And I didn't spend 9 years learning to be a historian just so you guys can think you can write it too. So that's where I'm at, and you will see in the handout it mentions at the end IOTA, which you can find in e-fanzines. So if you're interested, that's where you can look.
Can I ask you a question?
No. Yes, Lee, keep going.
Are you looking for a wider audience than just the fan people?
No. Actually, it's already going to a few historians. I'm associated with the Federation University as a senior honorary research fellow in the Circa. What's Circa stand for? See, as you get older, these things happen. It goes there. It goes to a couple of other historians and librarians get the thing. Actually, I was originally going to call it Working Papers, because the point of this particular e-fanzine is for me to work through a whole series of ideas about what fandom is about. But if you want it, that's fine. If you come across it, that's fine too. I want to now move us on to talking about the things about the past of science fiction. What on earth is Bill doing?
Answering his phone.
He didn't tell everybody to turn off their phones.
I didn't tell people to turn off their
phones.
He's
probably gone for a jab.
No, he's answering his phone.
He's actually talking to somebody who put on the phone. Okay, yeah. We want to start talking about the history of science fiction fandom in Australia, and I want to start off by talking about what it was that attracted people to science fiction in the first place, because science fiction was outside the pale. We live in a world these days where science fiction is commonplace, it's taken for granted, it's everywhere. in this period in which Dick and Lee discovered science fiction, it was quite a different world. Now, in asking them a question, I thought I'd better ask myself the question. Where did I first come across science fiction? I remembered that in 1956 I'd been stuck in bed for about 4 or 5 weeks with pneumonia. And so, as an eight-year-old, I was bored witless. But my parents bought me Eagle magazine with Dan Dare. Yes. Now, apart from the pictures, the story was actually quite science fictional, and the Mekon of Venus was an evil bugger beyond description. I was reading yesterday an article written by George Turner, if we remember George Turner, who was walking down Elizabeth Street in 1927, and he saw a cover of the first issue of Amazing Stories, and he was instantly addicted. So that, for some people, the introduction to science fiction is actually visual rather than literature. So let us turn to Dick. Your introduction to science, what was it that initially attracted you to science fiction?
I've always been a science fiction fan. I can't remember a time when I wasn't interested in the strange, the unusual, and the imaginative. My father was a science fiction fan. He probably would have read that first Amazing Story, but he never admitted it. He always pretended he didn't know anything about science fiction, even though he bought me science fiction magazines. At school, we had a teacher who read to us a story about a boy and his sister being taken by their uncle back to Jurassic times. I don't know who wrote the story. I thought it was a Professor Brainstorm story, but it wasn't. I then discovered awful science fiction in Australia, Thrills Incorporated, Vol Molesworth, and stuff like that. But then Race Matthews, I was at school with Race Matthews. We've known each other for over 70 years. And he pointed out that the library at school had Croft Conklin's first hardcover anthology, The Best of Science Fiction. He also pointed out that you could buy what I still think is the best anthology ever, Adventures in Time and Space, Healy and McComas. You could buy that in the city. But Race got together a group of various people who were interested in science fiction. Now, in 1952, at school, if you were interested, you were a wetweed, a drongo, and a dill. And I remember in English literature class, the teacher asked us to talk about a book we just read. I had just read Willie Ley's book, The Conquest of Space, which was not science fiction. So I put my hand up and said, let's talk about this. And I was shouted, or sniggered down, let's put it that way, by the rest of the class, who a few years later, 17 years later, would say, oh, we knew we were going to get to the moon anyhow. Now, in 1950, Robert Heinlein wrote a story called Destination Moon, which was turned into a film. And in that film, the people who wanted to build the rocket and get to the moon had to convince the backers to provide money. So what did they do? They showed the backers a film, a cartoon of Woody Woodpecker explaining why you didn't need air to push against to drive a rocket. Now, clearly, that was not for the people in the film, but for the people watching the film. So, coming back to what you just said, it was a non-technological society then, and if you believed in technology, you were, as I said, a wet weed, a drunk, especially if you made no bones about how passionate you were about science fiction. Do you want me to go on and say a bit more?
Yeah, give you another 30 seconds. No, more longer than that.
Okay.
Now, yes,
this
man.
This is 1952 or so.
Well, you're next.
And Lee will corroborate that there was very little science fiction to be found anywhere in the bookstalls or in the shops, but there was a library called Franklin's Library, which got American magazines put them between hard covers, and you could borrow them for a week at, I think it was sixpence.
Oh, it was paradise.
Yeah, at sixpence an issue. That was essentially the only real place where you could buy real science fiction.
Yes.
So let me just finish with that and just say that I've always been a science fiction fan, and I don't understand... Well, I do understand why some people are not science fiction fans. They lack imagination, wit, and intelligence.
Lee, I think you left out quite a lot. Bickford, it's early times. We'll get back to you in a moment. What was very important about the Melbourne Science Fiction Club was I keep finding similarities between science fiction, early science fiction clubs and jazz clubs that formed in America during the 30s, because they were considered a bit strange because they liked black music. So there's been an ongoing association virtually between jazz lovers and science fiction lovers. But what was amazing in those times, I mean, this is 1950s Australia. It was Wowsville. The pubs closed at 6 o'clock. And the husbands used to stagger home, tang tang. You know, it was a bit like America before Prohibition, during Prohibition, except, you know, they could guzzle a lot before 6 p.m. What the club provided was it didn't matter what your background was. Whether you were shy, homosexual, or nobody was interested. As long as you loved science fiction, you were welcome. There was no criticisms, or nobody was interested in your personal life. It was just enough that you were a fellow enthusiast. And so people, that's the way it was for science fiction. I mean, guys used to make fun of me when I went down the street. He thinks people are going to go to the moon. He's crazy. You know, so you were pretty much a social outcast if people knew you read science fiction. And there wasn't much around in Australia.
Lee, how did you discover it?
We didn't get the flood of American material until the import restrictions.
How did you discover that you like science fiction to start with?
Yes.
How?
How? Pretty much the same as well. I was and always have been, I suppose, what's commonly called an outsider.
How did you discover
that? He's about to say so. He's saying so. Keep going, Lee.
And I found a niche in science fiction fandom. It's not extraordinary that three major writers came out of the Melbourne Science Fiction Club. John Baxter, Damien Broderick, and some other fellow whose name I forget. So it was a breeding ground for fanzines were slow. I think John Baxter and Bob Smith in Sydney were the first. And then, of course, Etherline and perhaps and all that kind of along.
Lee, you're getting a little bit ahead of the game here. Can I get you two to talk about two things?
Yeah, yeah.
One is Franklin's.
Ah,
and
yes.
One is Operation Fantast.
Oh, Operation Fantast was the key to it all.
Yeah.
Yes.
Dick, were you a member of Operation Fantast?
No.
Did you know of it?
Yes, I knew of it, but I was never a member.
Right.
No.
Lee, explain Operation Fantast.
Well, I got involved with that first. I started reading at Franklin's. You had the beautiful American pulps, not so much Astounding, but the thrilling group, Thrilling Wonder Stories, Fantastic Startling Stories, they had letter columns that went for pages and replies from the editors and jokes and writers replying sometimes. The fanzine review column was called The Frying Pan, you know, with excellent writers working on that. And Operation Fantast was run by somebody serving in the British Army of Occupation on the Rhine. His name was Ken Slater, and he was connected to... There was world fandom at that stage. And American fans would purchase the American magazines and send them to Ken, and he would sell them through various... This was before the internet. It was all done by mail. You could get regular copies of all the American magazines by putting your name down with him. And it was through him and Operation Fantastic, it was called. He was the Australian representative, and that's how I met Race Matthews and then Dick and gotten involved in the whole business. It all came from this one source. And even though there was no internet in those days, as I said, fans communicated. There was already a worldwide link-up. Nothing like there is now when there's world conventions in Finland. I mean, that would have been inconceivable. It all goes back to the clubs, Lee, really, doesn't it? The ability to be accepted and not be a nut and not tolerated even, but, you know, enjoyed and encouraged. Yes.
Lee, yes. Can I add
you
to that?
You can.
Going on from what Lee said, I must say that the club was the best group therapy I've ever attended. It was, as Lee said, you were accepted there, not for any other reason apart from the fact that you enjoyed science fiction, you were passionate about it, you talked about it, and you knew that the ideas in science fiction, while most of them were very unscientific, some of them were real and introduced you to, in my case at least, very basic physics. So the club was just a great support group for someone who was not quite sure of their place in the world at the moment.
Dick, I'd like to add, is a former glaciologist, and you were instrumental in the installation of the first computer for the university, weren't you, Dick?
No, I used it. I used it.
Oh, you use it, right.
Yeah, for weather modelling.
Can I come in and say I got into...
Yes, you're the next generation.
And I was 10 years after these guys.
Yeah.
In the mid-50s, an Australian writer called Ivan Southall, who wrote Simon Black in Space. Mm-hmm. It was the first completely science-fictional book that I read, even though I'd read some H.G. Wells short stories. And I listened to a BBC radio show called Journey into Space.
Oh, yes.
And they had really bizarre music going, da-da-da-da-da, when it was the aliens messing with people's minds. And so that aroused my imagination. I read Lord of the Rings when I was 17. It was in the school library. And I was knocked out by that. That wasn't really science fiction. But in the local news agent, where I used to get the tram into school when I was 14 or 15, they had Galaxy magazine there. I used to buy that. And they had a book called Alice in Wonderland by Harlan Ellison, a collection of his short stories. And then one Saturday, looking in the Age newspaper, there was this tiny little ad for Australian Science Fiction Review. And I'd never heard of it before, hadn't heard of fandom before. This was in 1966. So I went to McGill's, where they said you could get it, and found that they had a library upstairs, and that Merv was there. Met John Bankson. Lee was co-editor. John made me assistant editor about a year later. And I was, I think that was an act of charity on his part.
I was a shadow editor too, wasn't I?
Yeah, you were.
Yeah. Right.
And I remember my father was an engineer, and we always had very strong scientific interests at home. And the other great thing about where we lived was the local library had Lorraine's Yellowback science fiction books, and so I read quite a few of the classics of science fiction that Gollancz published. And I remember bringing home a book called The Ethical Engineer, and my father saying, that's a bit unfair trying to get me to read science fiction by calling it that. That was Harry Harrison, of course. And those yellowbacks, I remember picking up Clash of Symbols by James Blish, and on the dust jacket on the blurb, it said, I misread it, and said this is a book about religious practices or something, when it actually, this is not a book about religious practices. So I put it straight back down again. Later on, I did read all of Blish, of course. That's how I got interested. So,
Rob, what worked for you in science fiction? What was it that, well, got you interested?
It actually was interesting stuff about the world that conventional books really were missing the point of, were not worrying about. Was talking about possibilities, about the future, about different ways of looking at the world. And if you read a typical novel, it's about the psychological problems of growing up in a family or in the workplace or in the family or with your brothers and sisters or with your parents or with your children or your lovers or your lack of lovers, all of which is a part of our lives, of course, but it's only one part. And science fiction talked about the much bigger part of the world.
Thank you.
Can I also add to that?
Yes.
Everything that has been said is correct, but I would like to add that I think science fiction in the 50s and early 60s was a very subversive literature.
Yes.
It introduced you to things that were just not talked about or openly discussed in everyday life. Melbourne, Australia was a very restrictive society in those days. And when you read a story like The Lovers by Philip Jose Farmer, it was a very, very emotional story about a man in love with an alien woman on another planet. The end of the story is she turns out to be an insect. So that story is, in effect, about interracial, interspecies sex. And yet it was so well written that one accepted it, as members of the Science Fiction Club accepted every other member of the Science Fiction Club. So,
even
yes.
The insects.
How did Annual Wave affect you guys in the 60s?
How did what?
The New Wave, all the, you know, hard
oh, love the sex.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was New Worlds was banned here for a time.
Yes, it was banned.
Yeah.
That's a total restrictive government.
Bub Jack Barron was banned.
Yeah.
I'm not too sure about camp concentration, but
we had to get bootleg copies from overseas. Yeah. Yes.
I remember New Worlds coming straight in. So that's where I read.
The big.
Yeah, the big one.
The big glossy one.
The four issues with Bub Jack Barron were banned. Then it was resumed.
Well, it must have been someone who smuggled them in, because that's where I read them.
Yeah,
from England.
Yeah. That's right.
Oh no, we're not going to get the New Wave. That'll be next year. Can I actually point out that I've been reading George Turner's remembrances of him becoming involved in the new in science fiction, and he calls the New Wave what happened just before the war. With Astounding and with the authors like Heinlein and Simak and Del Rey and Asimov and all these guys. He calls that a new wave.
That was a slightly different perspective.
No, exactly. Yeah. No. If we get together again next year, we'll get to the 60s. Promise. Because I need to talk about... I need to lead us on. We've got to a science fiction group in Melbourne, and I should point out it's called at this stage a Melbourne Science Fiction Group. It was not a formally organised organisation. You met at Val's, you met at People's Places.
That's right, very loose.
You found very loose because, and this is a totally different story, because the fans in Sydney were highly organised and fought all the time. There was some fighting in Melbourne, but very minor in comparison.
They were elitist in Sydney.
Yes. So what I want to talk about now is the creativity that fans have got. Now, there are two sides of creativity. One is, in fact, Lee's involved in both. There's more than three. What I want to do is hand out, if you really want to, you can keep a copy, but not if you're going to throw it out tomorrow. So can you pass out those copies of East Line? There's 20 of them. Pass them around. They're all dated 53 to about 56. There was 110 issues of the thing produced.
My evil past.
Yes, well, actually, the issue that Scott Lee Harding in it, I've given to him, he's kept. I think that may be a bonfire of the vanities later on. So I want to talk about the two forms of creativity in fan groups at this stage. One is producing fanzines, and the other one is about actually wanting to write science fiction. Now, just a little aside here. I was at the first national convention in 1966. Now, it was held in a room... Actually, the room would be about this size, I imagine, maybe smaller. And I must have been up the back. There was what we called the pro panel. If you've got a...
Lee?
Yes. Yeah, that's the 568 one.
Oh.
You can tell because it's got the prisoner symbol on the...
I've got one.
In any event... I've lost where I was. Oh, that's right. I'm must be standing up the back of the room. There's the pro panel on, and someone, probably Lee or Damien or someone, said, who here has tried to write science fiction? And just about everyone in the room stuck their hand up. So there's as well as being readers of science fiction, we want to create something. Now, one of the things that's easiest to create, perhaps, is fanzines. And Lee was probably the, well, from my point of view, in fact, one of the key fanzine producers in the 50s. But let's put that to one side. Let's talk about writing science fiction and getting science fiction published in Australia. Lee, you want to write science fiction. How did you do it?
Yeah. Well, I'd always wanted to be a writer. I can't remember a time when I didn't. You know, it's sort of carved on your temple when you're born or something. And I had read countless American pulps by this time. I used to bring home from Franklin's every weekend 6 pulp magazines. So I thought, you know, I could probably crack this market the way you do. But I realised that the sort of science fiction I wrote wasn't really modelled on the American pulps. I'd been reading British science fiction, New World, science fantasy, the Carnell magazines, as they were called, who was not as celebrated as he should be. He sort of wanted to be a John Campbell of England. And he had to find writers. There were one or two already there, but he published the first stories of J.G. Ballard and Michael Moorcock. And I have a cover that he always used to have the top writers on the cover. And the one I keep is the one, Brian Aldiss, J.G. Ballard and Lee Harding. Yes. I had a story in the first issue of Science Fiction Adventures that there was only 2 stories in it. One was mine, and the other was the first novelette version of The Drowned World by J.G. Ballard. What happened to me?
No, the answer is, Lee, you lived in Australia.
Yes, that's the point.
So I'm interested in how you actually establish a relationship. I mean, we've got Jackie, first, who comes from the heart of SF Publishing.
Yeah.
It must be.
With the first story with Ted, he discovered another writer, and he encouraged.
Because you could only do it by mail. You could only do it by writing to each other.
That's right, yeah. Blue air letters. We lived by them. Yeah, that was our means of communication. Posting a manuscript with return postage enclosed in case it wasn't accepted. I was fortunate. I sold my first story to him. Oddly enough, it was called Displaced Person. Which I, in later years, took the idea and wrote it the way I wanted to write it. My one lucky book. And he was very encouraging because he had to build up a stable of regular writers. I sold everything I wrote for the first 18 months. You know, I was on a winning streak until I got my first rejection. Ghastly.
But it never happened again.
No, I used the idea from that for my first novel years later. So, yeah, writers do this. They hate throwing anything away. And they usually go back to the core, to where they began. They gut the original manuscript. I'm currently doing that with an earlier draft of a overly ambitious novel. But that's okay. It's okay to be overly ambitious as long as you have own inbuilt shit detector. That's Ernest Hemingway's advice. You've got to read critically to order to read your own critically.
What Lee's found, though, is he had to go overseas to get a publisher.
That's right. From the very beginning, there were no local markets. A little one developed when it wasn't Thrills Incorporated, it was another little, you could hardly call them paperbacks, they were more like pamphlets, 32-page science fiction magazines monthly.
Who was publishing?
And it was Malian Press, and it didn't have a title as a series, it just published this novel. And Norma Hemming sold her first story to them. And the earlier variation, Thrillers Incorporated, was sheer junk. It was people think, just ordinary pulp writers here, thinking they could also write science fiction. Became infamous for pirating a story of Ray Bradbury's and publishing it under a pseudonym. So there were clearly people here who were interested in starting a magazine, but the numbers of people who would buy it were not sufficient to guarantee it.
Well, can we talk to two names? A Vision of Tomorrow and North Australia Press.
Ah, well, so much happened in 1975. The person who's missing from this panel played such a huge role in science fiction with Space Age books, which I helped him run. We were on the student run opposite the library. Our customers were students, intelligent, articulate readers, and they just fell out. We had a war of American science fiction. And I think it was this, too, which caused the explosion of interest and ensured that we could hold a Worldcon. That we had the numbers, we had the interest. It wasn't just our simple fan base, but all these other science fiction hungry people. And yes, it's a pity he can't be here, because he is the real father of all of us, including us on the panel, because he was the entry point. He proselytised in McGill's news agency. He stocked our fanzines and sold a few. He was, I would like to have honoured him today in that respect, that to remind him that for all his somberness, that he achieved so much. I remember when he sent us a message from saying, "I'm over Iceland drinking a Drambuie." How many people could say that? This is when he was going, because he attended all the Worldcon bids overseas. He was a tireless campaigner.
Dick, did you ever try writing, or was your forte art?
No, I did try writing. I was about 12 years old, and I started my first novel.
I remember it vividly.
5 pages into it, I decided that I couldn't possibly write another 200 pages.
Why is this?
So I gave up. I did write a couple of science fiction stories for Perhaps.
That's right. Yes.
And
under a pseudonym.
And a poem, and that was about it.
That's right.
Rob,
let me just say that I don't like writing. I much prefer drawing something or creating something.
As your Rotzler attests.
But writing. I have never really written a scientific paper. I'd give the results to my supervisor or the boss of the department, and he would write the paper and put up our names on it. I just don't like writing.
Mm. Yes. Fair enough. Rob?
Yeah, I always wanted to be a writer, and I am a somewhat indifferent writer. I wrote a couple of short stories. I sent to Fred Pohl, editing Lords of If, and he sent me letters back saying thanks, but no thanks. Unless you write to me, which is nice. I even sent him a cover design for If when I was about 15, I think, or maybe a little bit older.
I started.
Bruce, through SF Commentary, had written huge amounts of stuff on Philip Dick, and out of that came a book, Philip K. Dick, Electric Shepherd, which is a collection of part of Bruce's writing, an essay by Dick himself, by Stanislav Lev, and by other people. And that was the first book that was by an Australia Press.
Yes.
And Carey, I think, was supporting Bruce in putting that book together, and then I joined them, and we set up the company to publish Australian science fiction, not just Australian, any interesting science fiction, but primarily Australian. And we published things like Greg Egan's first novel, An Unusual Angle. Now he's much better known to most people by his publications in the States or the UK, but he's distributed here. We published Damien Broderick's probably his best book, The Dreaming Dragons. We published a quasi-science fictional book called The Plains by Gerald Murnane, which is still in print now as an Australian classic.
The Plains has been reissued as a classic by Text.
Yes.
Yeah.
And when I was putting together the best Australian science fiction writing over 50 years, which is from the mid-50s to the 2000s, Lee was mentioning science fiction adventures and new worlds. The Australian writers in here in the 50s couldn't get publication in Australia, but they could in the UK, Norma Hemmings, Wynne Whitford, Lee, Bertrand Chandler,
David
Rowe. Or they could get publication in the States, and Wynne was being published in the States as well.
Yes.
Wynne went to the United States for 6 months and established the contact, which taught him how to write American science fiction rather than what Lee had learnt to write for the English market.
Yeah.
Rob, why was it that fans had to publish this stuff? Why isn't someone else doing it?
I think it's the snobbery of the literary establishment. There are recognised genres, and so if you're writing a crime book, you can get publication. But usually that was outside Australia too. There was a publisher in Sydney who was published Man magazine and
Horwitz.
They published one of the most prolific writers ever. I forget who it was.
Carter Brown.
That's right. And
yes.
He wrote. They weren't really hack works because a couple of the books, Cold Dark Hours, is a brilliant short novel about corporate life. And I used to have a copy of that there, but some of the stuff is pretty routine. But he wrote probably 500 books in his lifetime, and many of them were published outside Australia as well. But if you weren't publishing that sort of stuff, if you weren't publishing the so-called serious fiction, publishers weren't interested in science fiction or fantasy. But we were, and we saw that there was good stuff being produced. We had huge numbers of manuscripts sent to us to read. We wanted to publish them, and we did. We got some grants from the Australia Council, which helped us cover some of the production costs. Each book funded the next one. And so none of our books were failures, because each earned enough money to enable us to do the next one until we got to about the mid-80s, and then we all got busy in other things, and we decided to call it a day. And I think other people were starting to publish stuff at the same time.
Yes, it was a great pioneering effort. It was extraordinary, and that at least two or three of the books are now acknowledged classics. Classics. Do we have any real classics?
I'm afraid George Turner probably wrote them.
Yes. No.
And George, another missing face.
The Sea and Summer.
And none of George's were published in Australia.
None of them published
in Australia. Only his early non-science fiction.
Publishers in general in this country, the big guns, are as parochial about science fiction as in the 60s. In the early 80s, an editor I worked with at Wren for Beyond Tomorrow, the anthology, went to work for as chief editor for Penguin. And she's another one of those people who can say, it's all your fault, Lee. She discovered science fiction by editing Beyond Tomorrow. And she was just an instant sort of fan, and she endeavoured to start a science fiction program at Penguin. And they had done paperback versions of four of my books. And, we had the usual dinners. Brian Johns was the... I was running then. He was keen. But the local books never took off. They did the paperback of The Dreaming Dragons. And one other, a alternate history by Bert Chandler. But there was always something about Penguin paperbacks that looked elitist. I don't know if you ever remember those, the ones that came out in those years, somber black covers and...
Somber Penguin books.
That's their special wine now.
Yeah.
And I discovered recently I was appalled to read a letter from some... it was in Lizzie's article on George Turner that was so splendid, that it was from a reader at Penguin who was rejecting doing a reprint of The Sea and Summer. I found that just ignorant and incomprehensible at this time, and for the usual stuffy Penguin reasons, as they were.
Rob, you were going to say?
Yeah, I say that one thing that did happen, I think Australia was part of how it happened, was, as Lee mentioned, Penguin published several of our books in paperback and got wider distribution. It was distribution that killed us. We had great trouble getting our books to readers. Maurice Schwartz, running then Outback Press, did a joint anthology that I edited called Transmutations of New Australian Writing. That was in 79. And with Penguin publishing some of our stuff, within about 10 years, by the 90s, HarperCollins were publishing a huge range of science fiction, and all the major publishers were suddenly seeing, and this is now a market that is viable. And if you go into bookshops today, there's a lot of Australian published science fiction and fantasy there in a way that there never used to be. And I think we showed it could be done. We showed that there's good writing around that could be have a wider appeal.
We do have to mention Paul Collins, of course.
No, we don't yet. We don't yet. We're running out of time. We've got about less than 10 minutes left.
Dick, but have some questions from the
Yeah, that's right.
Just two stories actually in his anthologies.
Dick, I just want to do a little summing up now. Of your experience as a science fiction fandom, what would you say is the most important, the most formative things?
I would like to say that science fiction changed my life, but the only way I could be sure was to go to an alternate universe and see what it would have been like without science fiction. But science fiction certainly changed my life. If it hadn't have been for science fiction, for putting me onto real science, I never would have taken a degree in physics at the university. I wouldn't have gone on to live a science fiction dream by using a giant brain for my master's degree, and I certainly wouldn't have loved the academic life so much that I kept on going. The reason why I stopped being that interested in science fiction was that I loved my job so much. I was working 60 hours a week because I wanted to.
Yes.
And as I say, if it hadn't have been for science fiction and for the support I got from the science fiction fans, I doubt that I would be here today. I probably would be in a gutter drinking some kind of mush. On the other hand, I probably could have been trying to persuade people to read A.A. Merritt's Ship of Ishtar. Everyone should read it.
Okay, Dick, if you're in the gutter, at least you'll be looking at the stars.
Please sum up.
Okay, what have I got from fandom? Solidarity in my difficult years was very important to me until I spread my wings and took off. As some of you know, I ceased writing and reading science fiction over 30 years ago. I'd had 30 years of it. And conventions and stuff. As I explained to John Clute, he asked why I wasn't writing it anymore, and I said, I just felt that science fiction for me had done its job, preparing the future generation for technological and social change, because that's what the writers of the 50s and 60s and into the early 70s were most writing about. You can't do that anymore. We're living in that world. I never expected to live in a world I wrote about.
Yeah.
I didn't imagine it was this awful. We were just playing with the future. You can't play with the future anymore. It's serious stuff now.
But Rob?
Well, all I can say is that science fiction has enriched my life, and it wouldn't be the same without it. And,
yes.
I had a huge library of science fiction books, and I sold about half of them to David Cyber, and but I needed a bit of money at one time. And,
when you could sell it.
Yes. All right.
When you could sell it, yeah.
We've had the 5-minute flag, so is anyone blowing up to... All right, yes.
I'm sorry I found a bad book, and now the title is Why 1975 Will convention was such a great landmark. Now, did I miss out you discussing that?
No, no. But, well, let's put it this way. We've done the 50s this year. If we come back next year, we'll do the 60s. If we come back the year after that, we'll do the 70s.
Yes, well, titles change.
No, more to the point. Because we had the fortunate ability to have these two guys here who could actually talk to us about the 50s and about the place of science fiction in the community, we've used it. And that happened since I wrote that little blurb. Next. Anyone else? No, good, we can go on. Bruce Gillespie. Bruce has the floor.
Oh.
Yeah,
this is actually my pal.
It's his panel.
Some wonderful person paid for my membership of this convention. I still have no idea who it was. So I was told that by the committee of the of Continuum. And I said, well, could I perhaps do a panel? And they said, oh, yes, you've got this time, the best time in the convention, 2 o'clock. And I said, I know the person who can do just the panel that's needed. The trouble is I did forget that it's 20 years since George Turner died, and I could have just as easily done a whole panel about the life and work of George Turner, but I probably would have had the same people...
It wouldn't have me.
And also, I would have covered very much the same territory. So anyway, this has worked out extremely well. Thank you very much, Lee, and the panelists.
All right. Anyone else?
Can I just make one quick comment?
Did you find this informative and interesting and entertaining? Okay.
You have a coda.
Quick comment, yeah, coda.
A coda.
They say that the strongest object is supported by three legs, and we have two of the pillars, and murder's the third pillar, but these two guys are real pillars of the science fiction world and founded in Australia.
Thank you, all you may depart. Good.
I'm free.
Thank you, Dick, for coming.
Well,
that was good.
Thank you for asking me. I'll try and make it next year.
Well, in fact, I was thinking that. In fact, I have almost the same panel for next year.
Will the books be out by then?
No, it won't. Oh, well, it won't be out for another 3 years. Because I'm... There's just so much material.
Is it?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, hello. No.
Yeah. Thank you.
Oh, right.
That's even better.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May I have a look at one of these?
Yes, certainly.
Thank you.
You mind if I put you on the list for IOTA? Then you'll see what I'm up to.
Perfect.
Okay, that'll be good. Nice to meet you.
Thank you for the opening paragraph.
One of your subscribers?
Well, a new subscriber. Oh, yes. All right. Let me turn the noise off.
May I hold on to this?
You may.
I'm a teacher of science fiction.
Jordan, keep it.
Thank you very much.